session number 25197, real form.
At that time, because there was this vast mob of people who were, they were literally trying to force their way into the dock. They wanted to, like us, they wanted to get away. And I think they sensed that they weren't going to, but they could see European people getting away. Now, I was caught up in the mob. I couldn't do anything about it, and I was pushed up against the cast iron railings. And there was one very friendly young man who actually arched himself across me, so that I wasn't crushed. And he was just a Tamil labourer, but he was very friendly. I couldn't understand a word he said, but he was very friendly and smiling. And in the circumstances, it was astonishing. I mean, they could have killed me easily. And on the other side of the road from the gates, there was a tall row of jacaranda trees, you know, the blue flowering trees. And it's a funny thing about India, and it was the same there, they all used to climb into the trees. All these people in the trees, looking down on this scene. I'm reasonably sure, in retrospect, that the Indian troops, who were under a British officer, of course, would have been given orders to fire if there had been any possibility of the gates giving way. I'm sure they would have been. I'm quite sure. And eventually, after what seemed like a lifetime, my father came out and we got away. But as we left, I don't know whether it would have been an anti-riot squad of police arrived, and it started to look rather ugly. So that was just one incident. But of course, it brought it home to me as a child, you know, that things were very, very much out of kilter, really, because I'd not seen scenes like that at all up to that point.
Were you making preparations, you know, to get away? I was wondering, you know, about luggage and what you were going to take, because obviously you had this big house in Singapore.
Yeah.
You know, what were the arrangements? Was it going to be that the whole family were going, or did your father have to stay, as you've explained, because of his commitment?
My father was employed, as I've already mentioned, by the Air Ministry. And when hostilities started on the 8th of December, 1941, he was granted the rank of commissioned officer in the Royal Air Force. And I believe that everybody who was employed by them at that time was also granted commissioned rank. So I think
he would have been in the Air Force then?
Yes. Well, he had a rather peculiar position in the sense that he was an Air Force officer, in effect, from that point on, and yet he continued to live and work. Oh, he was still going to Singapore, to Salita, by the way, you know, even through all that. He continued to live and work as a civilian, you see, but he was actually required to wear a uniform at certain points. So it changed on the 8th of December to that situation. Now, he managed to collect all the documents that were needed, and I learned then that we were going to go very shortly. But we were there over Christmas, and it was, how can I put it, my parents made the best effort they could to create a festive atmosphere, but of course people's minds were on other things. And I think it was one of the more depressing Christmases I've experienced. The other thing was that some of our domestic staff suddenly disappeared. I think they got the message and they just simply departed without any notice. And that was very difficult.
Was bombing going on in this time? You know, was the bombing continuing?
Yes, it was. Once the Japanese started, they carried on with their bombing campaign. Yes.
What was the feeling about the ability of Singapore, you know, given the naval presence there and the army as well as the Air Force to defend the island? You know, were people confident? Was there a feeling that the Japanese could be held off? Or what is your own memory of this time?
First of all, I think there was an air of incredulity that the Japanese had even had the temerity to, the impudence to attack us at all. And as with those circumstances, this is really why I was saying earlier that people tried to carry on as per normal, because I just don't think they really believed it was happening, you know, at first. And of course, I think we have to bear in mind that I had long discussions with both my parents after the war when I was an adult, so they filled in some of the details for me. But I remember them saying that they really couldn't believe that it was happening at first. Everybody reacted, as I think the Americans must have done, to the news of Pearl Harbor, you know, that it just couldn't take it in that this was actually happening. Preparations were not good. Now, Lieutenant General Percival had been appointed to General Officer Commanding GOC there in April 1941. And to be fair to him, he had done a lot of preparatory work in assessing the situation. But of course, I think most of us know that the forces in the Far East were kept short of men and material to a considerable extent. Churchill made the mistake of sending the two warships, the Prince of Wales and Repulse.
Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. I was taken to the docks by my father. I think it was literally the day they arrived, on the 8th of December. And I remember seeing one of them lying in the docks there. And there was the interesting thing was that there were so many local people went to the docks as well, and they were all cheering them. They were all, I'm sure, confident that this was all that was needed, you know, to rectify the situation. And of course, we all know what happened. A day or two later, they went out to the Gulf of Thailand and they were sunk.
Do you remember hearing the news of that?
Oh, yes.
Did it cause a lot of consternation?
Yes. Very great deal. Yes, very great deal. And of course, we didn't have much in the way of an air force either. Old aircraft, you know, that had been built probably in the early 30s, maybe even the late 20s. They just simply weren't up to dealing with the Zeros, Japanese Zeros.
I'm afraid your father would have been well abreast of that, wouldn't he?
Oh, very much so, yes. Oh, yes, very much so. I think there was, I'm not saying there was an air of panic. There wasn't. I think that would be a distortion, perhaps, to say that. But there was an air of great anxiety. And the usual thing happened, you know, there were military patrols suddenly started to appear, police patrols. When we were in the car going around the city, we were stopped from time to time. My father had to have a special pass. The usual security measures were put in place. But of course, I've argued this with people up to the present day. Singapore in those days was what I think one might truly call a multicultural city in the proper use of the term. It was truly multicultural. And all the time that there was peace and prosperity for a great many people, it all held together very well. But as soon as it came under pressure from an outside force, the Japanese army, the lack of a core loyalty became very apparent. And I'm having arguments with my friends and some of my relatives about this, even to this day, because this situation exists here now.
And since September the 11th?
No.
Do you mean?
Well, perhaps yes, but I think before that, really. Some young Muslim men in this country have gone to fight on the other side. So I feel that sometimes, looking at this country now, that I'm seeing the creation of a similar situation, perhaps over a longer period of time. But those people, whether they were Indian or Chinese or Malay or British or other Europeans, they had loyalties to their own community. But there wasn't the kind of core loyalty, the cohesion, if one prefers that, which meant that when that society came under pressure, people pulled together, as, for example, they did here under Churchill in 1940. He appealed to the country as a whole. It didn't matter whether people were Irish, English, Scottish, or whatever. We all knew, I wasn't here, but people who were, knew that if they didn't pull together, they'd hang separately, as it were. But there wasn't this identity, this common identity. Chinese people identify with their own, Indians, etc.
Does that mean that trust went?
Yes. Yeah. And this is what happened, as I was saying earlier, in India, when Indian troops who were captured went over to the Japanese. There wasn't that degree of trust in the leadership that we had here in this country in 1940. It didn't exist in Singapore, in my opinion, either. I think looking back on it, the cultural, it's not so much the ethnic differences, although they are very important. It's the cultural differences that are so fundamental. And if there isn't that common identity, then one hasn't got a nation. It was more a community of different ethnic makeup.
So,
and it began to show.
Yes, how did your preparations go? You know, were you deciding what you should take to Australia?
My father made inquiries, and we were told, first of all, they packed, as people do, you know, almost like you're going on holiday, you know, as if you're going on holiday. It was all put into the trunks and the bags, you see. And then my father was told we would take just one relatively small piece each. So it all had to be unpacked. It was as plain as a pikestaff, of course, as we got towards after Christmas, that we weren't going to be able to take anything really of significance.
So can you remember what you did take?
Just a small case that I could carry as a boy with some clothes in it. That was it.
And you would all have that, would you? The whole four of you? Is that
well,
right?
That was my mother. She had a slightly bigger case. I myself had a smaller case. And then my first sister, she was able to carry a small case. And, of course, the youngest child was only 38, 39, 40, 40, about three. So she couldn't carry anything. We had to carry her. We had to carry her as well as her case. And that was really what we took with us when we left, just four cases.
Mm. Could you tell me about the departure?
Mm. My father one morning said that we had to go to a place off Orchard Road to collect the final documents. And he'd got a passage on a ship, which was the SS Orion, which was a Peninsula and Orient ship, I think. And we went to this official building in official office in Orchard Road. My mother and myself were there, and he went to the counter while we waited, and he collected the documents. It took quite a long time, and then he came back to where we were standing, and he took me to a chair that was in the corner, and he sat down. He took my hands, and he said, "You've got to leave Singapore with your mother now, but I can't come with you. I'm afraid I've got to stay here." The men were not permitted to go, and he said, "You're going to have to be the man of the family for the time being, and I want you to look after your mother and the girls."
And you were nine. Mm. That must have been very sad, was it, for you?
Upsets me now. So, on the 31st of December, the car came round to the front of the house in the morning, driven by the Malay side. And we put our luggage in, and my parents got in with us. We said goodbye to our servants who stood at the front door and said, "We'll be back." I can remember saying, "See you soon." We didn't really understand at all. I think they did, though. And we went down to the docks, which were under air attack, and the ship was not at the quayside. It was still, I think, being discharged from a dry dock. It took a long time for the ship to appear. It did appear. We finally got on board. We went up to the sports deck, to the rail, as people do when the ship's leaving quayside. And my father, together with all the other fathers, and standing on the dockside. The ship pulled away. We went out into Keppel Harbour, as I think it's still known. And as we pulled out into the harbour, there was an air raid alarm went off, the ship's bells were used for that purpose. We had to go down and sit by our cabins, but sit in the corridor. And I can remember sitting with my back to the wall and looking up and down the corridor, and all these women and children sitting as we were, either side of us, all the way down the length of the corridor. And as we sat there and the ship pulled out of the harbour, we could feel the vibration of bombs exploding in the water. And when I was in Singapore in May 2001, staying with my Chinese friend whom I mentioned before. Now, he was a boy a little bit older than I was then. He was 12, I was 9. And he said to me, I can assure you, because he lived there, of course, through the Japanese occupation as a Chinese person. And he said, "I can assure you that you were very, very lucky indeed, because only a few ships actually survived it." What we didn't know at the time was we got away, and it was daylight, by the way, we didn't leave at night. But the harbour was under attack all the time. What we didn't appreciate then was that the Japanese were dropping not only high explosive bombs, but delayed action incendiary bombs. One of them, by some means, went down one of the air vents that were quite a common feature of ship design in those days. And when we had been out at sea about 3 days, it exploded at night underneath the cabin where my mother and I, my two sisters were occupying, and set the ship on fire. Now, we had a cabin below the waterline, so we didn't have a porthole. So the cabins at that level were all dependent on mechanical air ventilation. And it would have been about 2 a.m. And my mother got up, or at least she switched on her bunk light and woke me up and said, "Do you think it's very hot in here?" And it was roasting, it was like an oven. Much, much hotter than it had been the previous 2 nights. Because one has to bear in mind that we were round about the equator there. So it was very, very hot indeed all the time. But it was much hotter than usual. And I said to her, "Yes, it's terribly hot in here." I was suddenly aware of it, having been woken up. She swung her legs over the side of the bunk, because I was on an upper bunk, she was on the lower bunk. She and the girls continued to sleep. She put her feet on the deck and immediately leapt up. The deck was so hot she couldn't stand on it. Now, what had happened was this bomb had gone down an air shaft into a space below the cabin, I don't know what it was, and had exploded and set the ship on fire. So she said to me, "Wake the girls and get them out of bed." And we had to, of course, put the stoutest shoes on that we could find, because the deck was really hot. And while I woke the girls up and got them into their dressing gowns, She went out into the corridor, which was then already filling with smoke, and hammered on all the doors, you know, shouting at people to get up. And eventually the fire alarm went off, and everybody came up to the upper decks, and the ship was on fire. So what they did was that they divided the... And this is where my memory is not completely clear, but I can't do any better than this. They divided the passengers. The ship was the Orion was designed, I would think from memory, for about 400 passengers maximum. And there were about 600 women and children, so it was very crowded. And some people, from what I remember, didn't even have a cabin to go in. They slept in the public rooms. And they divided the passengers into two roughly equal halves. And they put one half in the bow, in the front part of the ship, on the upper decks, of course, and the other half at the rear, the stern of the ship, because the fire was in the central part of the ship. And then this was 2 in the morning, of course, 2:15, 2:30 in the morning, pitch dark. And then they set about fighting the fire. And when the dawn came, we were sitting on the deck with our backs against the rails, and many, many other people all around us, of course. And there was an enormous plume of smoke going up thousands of feet into the sky, advertising our presence to every Japanese aircraft and ship in the area. And it looked as if things were getting to be quite bad in actual fact. All they could provide was a drink. That's all we got that morning. And of course some women had babies with them, so it was very difficult. And it was very hot. There wasn't much protection from the sun. And then something happened that really surprised us. A British warship suddenly appeared and pulled in alongside, probably, I don't know, 40, 50 feet away. And they sent across a large team of people who assisted the crew of the Orion with extra hoses and other equipment. And they eventually got on top of it and put it out. My mother said to me after the war, when we were discussing it, she said, I can't tell you how grateful I was to see that ship, because, she said, I had realised by that time that, left to ourselves, we were not going to get it under control. And I was sitting there during the morning talking to my mother, and I said, what's going to happen, do you think, if the ship sinks? I quite distinctly remember saying this. And she was looking down at the water, and she said to me, I wouldn't worry if I were you. And I followed her gaze down, and there were two large sharks cruising past. She was totally realistic. Completely realistic about it. And an extraordinary thing happened to me many, many years later, back in 1978. I was an architect working in London. I was involved in as a partner in a firm then, and we were dealing with one of the partners of a firm of quantity surveyors. There's a chap named Berryman, and he was about 10 years older than I was. I was then in my early 50s, he was in his early 60s. And it turned out that I don't know how we got onto the subject, he had been a midshipman in that warship that had assisted us to put the fire out. So he said to me, you and I then were actually on the same ship, in the same ship at one point in our lives. And I said, yes, except that we didn't know it. Astonishing, isn't it? What a small world.
Yes, I suppose lifeboats and that would have been impossible with such a crowd of people, would it?
The lifeboats, in my experience, I have literally circumnavigated the world by sea, and I've been in many ships, and I'm of the opinion that the designers of ships do not allow sufficient lifeboat capacity for everybody. They don't. Even on the Titanic, I don't think there were enough lifeboats. It's just accepted that you can't carry that many boats. No, they would have put the most vulnerable people, women with babies and, this, and people of that sort, into the lifeboats. And people like my mother and I would probably have had to take a chance.
Were there any Japanese circling around?
No, not at all.
Time,
no.
Or shipping?
We did. In the first day or two, we did have air raid alarms, but nothing, as far as I remember anyway, nothing ever came of it. And gradually the ship was brought back to some kind of working order. The warship left. But a lot of damage had been done. And we eventually arrived in Perth in Western Australia. I think the total journey time, seem to remember my mother remarking on it on occasion, it was actually quite fast. We did in about 9 days, which is very unusual. Even allowing for the fact that we were virtually stationary in the water for 1 day.
And were you able to get provisions and that? Once
cold
the ship was underway?
Cold food. A lot of the kitchens had been damaged. A lot of damage had been done. Yeah. And we didn't have the facilities that we would normally have had. But in the circumstances, I suppose most of us felt that we were, there was no complaining, let's put it that way.
End of reel 4, Derek Bartlett.